Hey there, it's Cory Doctorow, and you're tuned in once again to my weekly podcast, where I'm reading to you these days from Bruce Sterling's incredible history of the early days of the civil liberties movement online, The Hacker Crackdown, the 1992 book that was the first bit of literary freeware I ever stumbled upon, and presaged all of the Creative Commons movement in a tiny little nutshell. That Bruce is a smart guy. So I'm just back from Berlin. I arrived yesterday. I was there for the Web 2.0 Expo, the O'Reilly Conference. I gave a little talk on civil liberties and met a number of you, and it was nice to meet you. Berlin was nice too, although my fiance was supposed to accompany me, and she took ill and couldn't. So I mostly just sat around the room and wrote 6 columns, which did keep me very busy. I am now clear for columns for like 6 weeks, which means that I can get to work on some bigger and more ambitious projects. Speaking of, I have 2 short stories on the go, as I mentioned before. One is called The Things That Make Me Weak and Strange Get Engineered Away, the line from the Jonathan Coulton song, obviously. It's a story for a new market that I'm not allowed to talk about, but it will be an online market, and it's a story about the difference between surveillance and knowing yourself. Also in the final stretch of a short story I'm writing with Ben Rosenbaum, who's one of the great writers of our age, I think. And Ben and I have been working on a story called True Names, and it is a deeply weird, incredibly trans-everything story, and should be done soon. A couple of promising leads on an office. Thank you to everyone who wrote to me with suggestions. With any luck, I'll have something within a week or so. I would be going to look at an office tomorrow. Unfortunately, I'm off to San Francisco for a Boing Boing meeting. I'm literally flying 14 hours, having a 6-hour meeting, and flying 14 hours back again, getting home on Thursday morning. I know that this is crazy, but when you have a pregnant person at home that you're taking care of, you really want to stay home and not traipse around the world. So that's, in fact, what I'm doing. My laptop saga continues. IBM has now replaced every component on my ThinkPad X60, and it continues to have hardware failures. They use refurbished parts, because after the first year, they stop manufacturing parts for it. And so this machine has had like 5 refurbished motherboards in it, and they finally got it to the point where the fan no longer sounds like a Buick, and the sound actually works, although I haven't been able to get my USB headset to work with it again. But now it won't work with the docking station. So it's going back to them for a 6th motherboard swap. I really hope that this one takes, because there's a limit to how many times I want to have the logic board in this machine replaced. I have to say, it's good hardware, but when it fails, their engineering is not particularly great. Or at least the engineering QA for their part stream is not particularly great. Well, you've heard enough of me kvetching. Let's read a little Bruce Sterling. The Federal Computer Investigations Committee, FCIC, is the most important and influential organization in the realm of American computer crime. Since police of other countries have largely taken their computer crime cues from American methods, the FCIC might well be called the most important computer crime group in the world. It is also, by federal standards, an organization of great unorthodoxy. State and local investigators mix with federal agents. Lawyers, financial auditors, and computer security programmers trade notes with street cops. Industry vendors and telco security people show up to explain their gadgetry and plead for protection and justice. Police investigators, think tank experts, and industry pundits throw in their 2 cents worth. The FCIC is the antithesis of a formal bureaucracy. Members of the FCIC are obscurely proud of this fact. They recognize their group as aberrant, but are entirely convinced that this, for them, outright weird behavior is nonetheless absolutely necessary to get their jobs done. FCIC regulars from the Secret Service, the FBI, the IRS, the Department of Labor, the offices of federal attorneys, state police, the Air Force, from military intelligence, often attend meetings held hither and thither across the country at their own expense. The FCIC doesn't get grants, it doesn't charge membership fees, it doesn't have a boss, it has no headquarters, just a mail drop in Washington, D.C., at the Fraud Division of the Secret Service. It doesn't have a budget, it doesn't have schedules. It meets 3 times a year, sort of. Sometimes it issues publications, but the FCIC has no regular publisher, no treasurer, not even a secretary. There are no minutes of FCIC meetings. Non-federal people are considered non-voting members, but there's not much in the way of elections. There are no badges, lapel pins, or certificates of membership. Everyone is on a first-name basis. There are about 40 of them. No one knows how many exactly. People come, people go. Sometimes people go formally, but still hang around anyway. Nobody has ever exactly figured out what membership of this committee actually entails. Strange as it may seem to some, to anyone familiar with the social world of computing, the organization of the FCIC is very recognizable. For years now, economists and management theorists have speculated that the tidal wave of the information revolution would destroy rigid, pyramidal bureaucracies where everything is top-down and centrally controlled. Highly trained employees would take on much greater autonomy, being self-starting and self-motivating, moving from place to place, task to task, with great speed and fluidity. Adhocracy would rule, with groups of people spontaneously knitting together across organizational lines, tackling the problem at hand, applying intense computer-aided expertise to it, then vanishing whence they came. This is more or less what actually happened in the world of federal computing investigation. With the conspicuous exception of the phone companies, which are, after all, over 100 years old, practically any organization that plays any important role in this book functions just like the FCIC. The Chicago Task Force, the Arizona Racketeering Unit, the Legion of Doom, the Frat Crowd, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they all look and act like tiger teams or users groups. They are all electronic adhocracies, leaping up spontaneously to attempt to meet a need. Some are police. Some are, by strict definition, criminals. Some are political interest groups. But every single group has that same quality of apparent spontaneity. Hey gang, my uncle's got a barn. Let's put on a show. Every one of these groups is embarrassed by this amateurism, and, for the sake of their public image in a world of non-computer people, they all attempt to look as stern and formal and impressive as possible. These electronic frontier dwellers resemble groups of 19th century pioneers hankering after the respectability of statehood. There are, however, two crucial differences in the historic experience of these pioneers of the 19th and 21st centuries. First, powerful information technology does play into the hands of small, fluid, loosely organized groups. There have always been pioneers, hobbyists, amateurs, dilettantes, volunteers, movements, users groups, and blue ribbon panels of experts around. But a group of this kind, when technically equipped to ship huge amounts of specialized information at lightning speed to its members, to government, and to the press, is simply a different kind of animal. It's the difference between an eel and an electric eel. The second crucial change is that American society is currently in a state approaching permanent technological revolution. In the world of computers particularly, it is practically impossible to ever stop being a pioneer, unless you either drop dead or deliberately jump off the bus. The scene has never slowed down enough to become well institutionalized. After 20, 30, 40 years, the computer revolution continues to spread, to permeate new corners of society. Anything that really works is already obsolete. If you spend your entire life working as a pioneer, the word pioneer begins to lose its meaning. Your way of life looks less and less like an introduction to something else, and more stable and organized, and more like just the way things are. A permanent revolution is really a contradiction in terms. If turmoil lasts long enough, it simply becomes a new kind of society. Still the same game of history, but new players and new rules. Apply this to the world of late 20th century law enforcement, and the implications are novel and puzzling indeed. Any bureaucratic rulebook you write about computer crime will be flawed when you write it, and almost an antique by the time it sees print. The fluidity and fast reactions of the FCIC give them a great advantage in this regard, which explains their success. Even with the best will in the world, which it does not, in fact, possess, it is impossible for an organization the size of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation to get up to speed on the theory and practice of computer crime. If they tried to train all their agents to do it, it would be suicidal, as they would never be able to do anything else. The FBI does try to train its agents in the basis of electronic crime at their base in Quantico, Virginia. And the Secret Service, along with many other law enforcement groups, runs quite successful and well-attended training courses on wire fraud, business crime, and computer intrusion at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, FLETC, pronounced FLETC, in Glencoe, Georgia. But the best efforts of these bureaucracies does not remove the absolute need for a cutting-edge mess like the FCIC. For you see, the members of the FCIC are the trainers of the rest of law enforcement. Practically and literally speaking, they are the Glencoe Computer Crime Faculty by another name. If the FCIC went off the cliff on a bus, U.S. law enforcement community would be rendered deaf, dumb, and blind in the world of computer crime, and would swiftly feel a desperate need to reinvent them. And this is no time to go starting from scratch. On June 11, 1991, I once again arrived in Phoenix, Arizona for the latest meeting of the Federal Computer Investigations Committee. This was more or less the 20th meeting of this stellar group. The count was uncertain since no one could figure out whether to include the meetings of the colloquy, which is what the FCIC was called into the mid-1980s before it even managed to obtain the dignity of its own acronym. Since my last visit to Arizona in May, the local AzScam bribery scandal had resolved itself in a general muddle of humiliation. The Phoenix chief of police, whose agents had videotaped 9 state legislators up to no good, had resigned his office in a tussle with the Phoenix City Council over the propriety of his undercover investigations. The Phoenix chief could now join Gail Thackery and 11 of her closest associates in the shared experience of politically motivated unemployment. As of June, resignations were still continuing at the Arizona Attorney General's office, which could be interpreted as either a new broom sweeping clean or a Night of the Long Knives Part 2, depending on your point of view. The meeting of FCIC was held at the Scottsdale Hilton Resort. Scottsdale is a wealthy suburb of Phoenix, known as Scottsdale to scoffing local trendies, but well equipped with posh shopping malls and manicured lawns, while conspicuously undersupplied with homeless derelicts. The Scottsdale Hilton Resort was a sprawling hotel in postmodern crypto southwestern style. It featured a mission bell tower, plated in turquoise tile and vaguely resembling a Saudi minaret. Inside, it was all barbarically striped Santa Fe-style decor. There was a health spa downstairs and a large, oddly shaped pool in the patio. A poolside umbrella stand offered Ben and Jerry's politically correct Peace Pops. I registered as a member of the FCIC, attaining a handy discount rate, and then went in search of the feds. Sure enough, at the back of the hotel grounds came the unmistakable sound of Gail Thackery holding forth. Since I had also attended the Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference, about which more later, this was the second time I had seen Thackery in a group of her law enforcement colleagues. Once again, I was struck by how simply pleased they seemed to see her. It was natural that she'd get some attention, as Gail was one of two women in a group of some 30 men. But there was a lot more to it than that. Gail Thackery personifies the social glue of the FCIC. They could give a damn about her losing her job with the Attorney General. They were sorry about it, of course, but hell, they'd all lost jobs. If they were the kind of guys who like steady, boring jobs, they never would have gotten into computer work in the first place. I wandered into her circle and was immediately introduced to 5 strangers. The conditions of my visit to the FCIC were reviewed. I would not quote anyone directly. I would not tie opinions expressed by the agencies of the attendees. I would not, a purely hypothetical example, report the conversation of a guy from the Secret Service talking quite civilly to a guy from the FBI, as these two agencies never talk to each other, and the IRS, also present, also hypothetical, never talks to anybody. Worse yet, I was forbidden to attend the first conference, and I didn't. I have no idea what the FCIC was up to behind closed doors that afternoon. I rather suspect that they were engaging in a frank and thorough confession of their errors, goof-ups, and blunders, as this has been a feature of every FCIC meeting since their legendary Memphis beer bust of 1986. Perhaps the single greatest attraction of FCIC is that it is a place where you can go, let your hair down, and completely level with people who actually comprehend what you are talking about. Not only do they understand you, but they really pay attention, and they are grateful for your insights, and they forgive you, which, in 9 cases out of 10, is something even your boss can't do, because as soon as you start talking ROM, BBS, or T1 trunk, his eyes glaze over. I had nothing much to do that afternoon. The FCIC were beavering away in their conference room. Doors were firmly closed, windows too dark to peer through. I wondered what a real hacker, a computer intruder, would do at a meeting like this. The answer came at once. He would trash the place. Not reduce the place to trash in some orgy of vandalism, that's not the use of the term in the hacker milieu. No, he would quietly empty the trash baskets and silently raid any valuable data indiscreetly thrown away. Journalists have been known to do this. Journalists hunting information have been known to do almost every single unethical thing that hackers have ever done. They also threw in a few awful techniques all their own. The legality of trashing is somewhat dubious, but it is not, in fact, flagrantly illegal. It was, however, absurd to contemplate trashing the FCIC. These people knew all about trashing. I wouldn't last 15 seconds. The idea sounded interesting, though. I'd been hearing a lot about the practice lately. On the spur of the moment, I decided I would try trashing the office across the hall from the FCIC, an area which had nothing to do with the investigators. The office was tiny, 6 chairs, a table. Nevertheless, it was open, so I dug around its plastic trash can. To my utter astonishment, I came up with torn scraps of a Sprint long-distance phone bill. More digging produced a bank statement and scraps of a handwritten letter, along with gum, cigarette ashes, candy wrappers, and a day-old issue of USA Today. The trash went back in its receptacle while the scraps of data went into my travel bag. I detoured through the hotel souvenir shop for some scotch tape and went up to my room. Coincidence or not, it was quite true. Some poor soul had, in fact, thrown a Sprint bill into the hotel's trash. Date May 1991. Total amount, $252.36. Not a business phone either, but a residential bill in the name of someone called Evelyn. Not her real name. Evelyn's record showed a past due bill. Here was her 9-digit account ID. Here was a stern computer-printed warning. Treat your phone card as you would any credit card. To secure against fraud, never give your phone card number over the phone unless you initiated the call. If you receive suspicious calls, please notify customer service immediately. I examined my watch. Still plenty of time for the FCIC to carry on. I sorted out the scraps of Evelyn's Sprint bill and reassembled them with fresh scotch tape. Here was her 10-digit phone card number. Didn't seem to have the ID number necessary to cause real fraud trouble. I did, however, have Evelyn's home phone number, and the phone numbers for a whole crowd of Evelyn's long-distance friends and acquaintances in San Diego, Folsom, Redondo, Las Vegas, La Jolla, Topeka, and Northampton, Massachusetts. Even someone in Australia. I examined other documents. Here was a bank statement. It was Evelyn's IRA account down at a bank in San Mateo, California. Total balance, $1,877.20. Here was a charge card bill for $382.64. She was paying it off bit by bit. Driven by motives that were completely unethical and prurient, I now examined the handwritten notes. They had been torn fairly thoroughly, so much that it took me almost an entire 5 minutes to reassemble them. They were drafts of a love letter. They had been written on the line stationery of Evelyn's employer, a biomedical company, probably written at work when she should have been doing something else. Dear Bob, not his real name, I guess in everyone's life there comes a time when hard decisions have to be made, and this is a difficult one for me, very upsetting. Since you haven't called me, and I don't understand why, I can only surmise it's because you don't want to. I thought I would have heard from you on Friday. I did have a few unusual problems with my phone, and possibly you tried. I hope so. Robert, you asked me to let go. The first note ended. Unusual problems with her phone? I looked swiftly at the next note. Bob, not hearing from you for the whole weekend has left me very perplexed. Next draft. Dear Bob, there's so much I don't understand right now, and I wish I did. I wish I could talk to you, but for some unknown reason you have elected not to call. This is so difficult for me to understand. She tried again. Bob, since I have always held you in such high esteem, I had every hope that we could remain good friends, but now one essential ingredient is missing. Respect. Your ability to discard people when their purpose is served is appalling to me. The kindest thing you could do for me now is to leave me alone. You are no longer welcome in my home and heart. Try again. Bob, I wrote a very factual note to you to say how much respect I had lost for you, by the way you treat people, me in particular, so uncaring and cold. The kindest thing you could do for me is to leave me alone entirely, as you are no longer welcome in my heart or home. I would sincerely appreciate it if you could retire your debt to me as soon as possible. I wish no link to you in any way. Evelyn. Good heavens, I thought. The bastard actually owes her money! I turned to the next page. Bob, very simple. Goodbye. No more mind games, no more fascination, no more coldness, no more respect for you. It's over. Finis. Evie. There were two versions of the final brush-off letter, but they read about the same. Maybe she hadn't sent it. The final item in my illicit and shameful booty was an envelope addressed to Bob, at his home address, but it had no stamp on it, and it hadn't been mailed. Maybe she'd just been blowing off steam because her rascal boyfriend had neglected to call her one weekend. Big deal. Maybe they kissed and made up, and maybe she and Bob were down at Pop's Chocolate Shop now, sharing a malted. Sure. Easy to find out. All I had to do was call Evelyn up. With a half-clever story and enough brass-plated gall, I could probably trick the truth out of her. Phone freaks and hackers deceive people over the phone all the time. It's called social engineering. Social engineering is a very common practice in the underground, and it's almost magically effective. Human beings are almost always the weakest link in computer security. The simplest way to learn things you are not meant to know is to simply call up and exploit the knowledgeable people. With social engineering, you use the bits of specialized knowledge that you already have as a key to manipulate people into believing that you are legitimate. You can then coax, flatter, or frighten them into revealing almost anything you want to know. Deceiving people, especially over the phone, is easy and fun. Exploiting their gullibility is very gratifying. It makes you feel very superior to them. If I'd been a malicious hacker on a trashing raid, I would now have Evelyn very much in my power. Given all this inside data, it wouldn't take very much effort at all to invent a convincing lie. If I were ruthless enough, and jaded enough, and clever enough, this momentary indiscretion of hers, maybe committed in tears, who knows, could cause her a whole world of confusion and grief. I didn't even have to have a malicious motive. Maybe I'd be on her side, and I'd call up Bob instead, and anonymously threaten to break both his kneecaps if he didn't take Evelyn out for a steak dinner pronto. It was still profoundly none of my business. To have gotten this knowledge at all was a sordid act, and to use it would be to inflict a sordid injury. To do all these awful things would require exactly zero high-tech expertise. All it would take was the willingness to do it and a certain amount of bent imagination. I went back downstairs. The hard-working FCIC, who had labored 45 minutes over their schedule, were through for the day and adjourned to the hotel bar. We all had a beer. I had a chat with a guy about ISIS, or rather IACIS, the International Association of Computer Investigation Specialists. They're into computer forensics, the techniques of picking computer systems apart without destroying vital evidence. IACIS, currently run out of Oregon, is comprised of investigators in the US, Canada, Taiwan, and Ireland. Taiwan and Ireland, I said? Are Taiwan and Ireland really in the forefront of this stuff? Well, not exactly, my informant admitted. They just happen to have been the first ones to have caught on by word of mouth. Still, the international angle counts, because this is obviously an international problem. Phone lines go everywhere. There was a Mountie here from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He seemed to be having quite a good time. Nobody had flung this Canadian out because he might pose a foreign security risk. These are cyberspace cops. They still worry a lot about jurisdictions, but mere geography is the least of their trouble. NASA had failed to show. NASA suffers a lot from computer intrusions, in particular from Australian raiders and a well-trumpeted Chaos Computer Club case, and in 1990 there was a brief press flurry when it was revealed that one of NASA's Houston branch exchanges had been systematically ripped off by a gang of phone freaks. But the NASA guys had their funding cut. They were stripping everything. Air Force OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, is the only federal entity dedicated full-time to computer security. They had been expected to show up in force, but some of them had canceled. Pentagon budget pinch. As the empties piled up, the guys began joshing and telling war stories. These are cops, Thackeray said tolerantly. If they're not talking shop, they talk about women and beer. I heard the story about the guy who asked for a copy of a computer disk, photocopied the label on it. He put the floppy disk onto the glass plate of the photocopier. The blast of static when the copier worked completely erased all the real information on the disk. Some other poor souls threw a whole bag of confiscated diskettes into the squad car trunk next to the police radio. The powerful radio signal blasted them, too. We heard a bit about Dave Jennison, the first computer prosecutor, a mainframe runner in Dade County, turned lawyer. Dave Jennison was the one guy who had hit the ground running, a signal virtue in making the transition to computer crime. It was generally agreed that it was easier to learn the world of computers first, than police or prosecutorial work. You could take certain computer people and train them to be successful police to do successful police work, but of course they had to have the cop mentality. They had to have street smarts, patience, persistence, and discretion. You've got to make sure they're not hotshots, show-offs, or cowboys. Most of the folks in the bar had backgrounds in military intelligence, or drugs, or homicide. It was rudely opined that military intelligence was a contradiction in terms, while even the grisly world of homicide was considered cleaner than drug enforcement. One guy had been way undercover doing dope work in Europe for 4 years straight. I'm almost recovered now, he said, deadpan, that with the acid black humor that is pure cop. Hey, now I can say fucker without putting mother in front of it. One guy, a founder of the FCIC, who'd been with the group since it was called the Colloquy, described his own introduction to the field. He'd been a Washington, D.C. homicide guy called in on a hacker case. From the word hacker, he'd naturally assumed that he was on the trail of a knife-wielding marauder and went to the computer center expecting blood or a body. When he finally figured out what was happening there, after loudly demanding, in vain, that the programmers speak English, he'd called headquarters and told them that he was clueless about computers. They told him nobody else knew diddly either, and get the hell back to work. So, he said, he had proceeded by comparisons, by analogy, by metaphor. Someone broke into your computer, huh? Breaking and entering. I can understand that. How'd he get in? Over the phone lines. Harassing phone calls. I can understand that. What we need here is a tap and trace. It worked. It was better than nothing. And it worked a lot faster when he got a hold of another cop who'd done something similar. And then the two of them got together, and another, and pretty soon the colloquy was a happening thing. It helped a lot that everyone seemed to know Carlton Fitzpatrick, the data processing trainer in Glencoe. The ice broke big time in Memphis in '86. The colloquy had attracted a bunch of new guys. Secret Service, FBI, military, other feds, heavy guys. Nobody wanted to tell anybody anything. They suspected that if word got back to the home office, they'd all be fired. They passed an uncomfortably guarded afternoon. The formalities got them nowhere, but after the formal session was over, the organizers brought in a case of beer. As soon as the participants knocked it off with the bureaucratic ranks and turf fighting, everything changed. I bared my soul, one veteran reminisced proudly. By nightfall, they were building pyramids of empty beer cans and doing everything but composing a team fight song. FCIC were not the only computer crime people around. There was DATTA, District Attorneys Technology Theft Association, though they mostly specialized in chip theft, intellectual property, and black market cases. There was the HTCIA, the High Tech Computer Investigators Association, also out in Silicon Valley, a year older than the FCIC and featuring brilliant people like Donald Ingraham. There was LEETAC, the Law Enforcement Electronic Technology Assistance Committee, in Florida, and computer crime units in Illinois and Maryland and Texas and Ohio and Colorado and Pennsylvania. But these were local groups. FCIC were the first to really network nationally and on a federal level. FCIC people live on the phone lines, not on bulletin board systems. They know very well what boards are, and they know that boards aren't secure. Everyone in the FCIC has a voice phone bill like you wouldn't believe. FCIC people have been very tight with the telco people for a long time. Telephone cyberspace is their native habitat. FCIC has three basic sub-tribes, the trainers, the security people, and the investigators. That's why it's called an investigations committee, with no mention of the term computer crime, the dreaded C-word. FCIC, officially, is an association of agencies rather than individuals. Unofficially, this field is small enough that the influence of individuals and individual expertise is paramount. Attendance is by invitation only, and most everyone in FCIC considers himself a prophet without honor in his own house. Again and again I heard this, with different terms but identical sentiments. I've been sitting in the wilderness talking to myself. I was totally isolated. I was desperate. FCIC is the best thing there is about computer crime in America. FCIC is what really works. This is where you hear real people telling you what's really happening out there, not just lawyers picking nits. We taught each other everything we knew. The sincerity of these statements convinces me that this is true. FCIC is the real thing, and it is invaluable. It is also very sharply at odds with the rest of the traditions and power structure in American law enforcement. There probably hasn't been anything as loose and go-getting as the FCIC since the start of the U.S. Secret Service in the 1860s. FCIC people are living like 21st century people in a 20th century environment. And while there's a great deal to be said for that, there's also a great deal to be said against it. And those against it happen to control the budgets. I listened to two FCIC guys from Jersey compare life histories. One of them had been a biker in a fairly heavy-duty gang in the 1960s. Oh, did you know so-and-so? Said the other guy from Jersey. Big guy? Heavy set? Yeah, I knew him. Yeah, he was one of ours. He was a plant in the gang. Really? Wow. Yeah, I knew him. Hell of a guy. Thackeray reminisced at length about being tear-gassed blind in the November 1969 anti-war protest in Washington Circle, covering them for her college paper. Oh yeah, I was there, said another cop. Glad to hear that the tear gas hit something. Ha ha ha! He'd been so blind himself, he confessed, that later that day he'd arrested a small tree. FCIC people are an odd group. sifted out by coincidence and necessity, and turned into a new kind of cop. There are a lot of specialized cops in the world, your bunco guys, your drug guys, your tax guys. But the only group that matches the FCIC for sheer isolation are probably the child pornography people, because they both deal with conspirators who are desperate to exchange forbidden data and also desperate to hide, and because nobody else in law enforcement even wants to hear about it. FCIC people tend to change jobs a lot. They tend not to get the equipment and training they want and need, and they tend to get sued quite often. As the night wore on and the band set up in the bar, the talk grew darker. Nothing ever gets done in government, someone opined, until there's a disaster. Computing disasters are awful, but there's no denying that they greatly help the credibility of the FCIC people. The internet worm, for instance. For years we'd been warning about that, but it's nothing compared to what's coming. They expect horrors, these people. They know that nothing will really get done until there is a horror.